Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hearst Ranch beef is 100% grass-fed, free-range, and always antibiotic-free. Our beef will be available in Whole Foods Market's 44 California locations from San Luis Obispo to San Diego throughout the summer beginning June 1st. You can also order our 100% grass-fed beef online as part of a partnership with Larder Meat Company. Visit HearstRanch.com. That's H-E-A-R-S-T, Ranch.
This week on Meet and Three, it's all about screens. We're diving into the world of TV, computers, and even VR to figure out how food consumption is shifted by a digital lens.
Every course talks about a different topic within the Asian American identity through a very personal lens. And the three courses that are paired with VR, in it, you're seeing a brushstroke by brushstroke recreation of the dish that you're about to eat.
Most of us in the world live in urban areas. And so how much is the city already accidentally providing its residents? And how much more could it provide if we just made it a priority?
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's episode, longtime friend of the Tunes, Maxwell Britton, returns to chat about his new role as chairman of the Hospitality Industry Reimagined Society Trust, or THIRST. Formed early on during the pandemic lockdown, the group is a national advocacy group with hyperlocal chapters that is focusing on getting insurance companies to honor small business claims for companies affected by the shutdown. We talk about the hurdles they're looking to overcome and how you, the listener, can get involved. Later on, we dip into our archives for a chat and live performance from the Vibe's favorite, 88 Palms. And if you've not gotten your copy yet, our new book, Snacky Tunes, Music is the Main Ingredient, is out internationally now on Faden and arriving in the U.S. and Australia on October 14th. Head to Faden.com or wherever you prefer to buy books. Thank you for tuning in. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes on HRN.
We talk about food. We talk about music.
Thank you.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On the phone with me today is an old friend of the tune, I think one of our earliest guests, Maxwell Britton. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes.
It's awesome to be back. Thank you for having me, man.
Yeah, so I know that you are wearing many, many hats these days, and we'll touch on a couple of them, but the reason why you're on here is because you recently accepted the role of chairman of the Hospitality Industry Reimagined Security Trust, or THIRST. You're already the New York State organizer. For those who are uninitiated, what is THIRST?
Well, THIRST is a 501c6, which makes us a not-for-profit lobby group, a national lobby group. And we are made up of hospitality leaders, lawyers, insurance experts, and we are fighting for responsible COVID regulation and with a specific focus on amending a lot of the bills for business interruption insurance for small business.
And we'll get to that in a second, but how was THIRST founded?
So it was actually founded by a guy named Nate Whitehouse, and he is a partner in a really great craft cachaça company called Avoir Cachaça, and he's also a partner with an international distribution company called Drifter Spirits. He's actually a lawyer by trade, before he's a beverage entrepreneur. And so he actually started doing kind of like a town hall, that was just sort of made up of like invite only hospitality leaders from across the country to discuss, you know, a lot of the issues that we're facing in the hospitality industry. And so it just sort of started out as like a collaborative discussion about, you know, where are the problems and what can we do to support this. And with the main thing that we identified, and this is because most of us are small business owners that were on this call, we were all talking about how none of us were able to get an approval for our business interruption insurance. And we started looking at it deeper and kind of realized that pretty much less than 1% of anybody that was filing for a business interruption approval from their insurance carriers were getting denied. And we were like, oh my God, this is really crazy, because, you know, this industry is sitting on around like $847 billion in reserves. And, you know, we all spend millions and millions of dollars every year to pay for this product that's supposed to be there for us to protect us in case we're forced into some kind of closure. And essentially, it's just getting denied across the board. And so since we had some lawyers that were a part of the team, we just started looking deeper into it and realized this was a problem everywhere. And so we began forming a group to build out an infrastructure so we could strategize how to change legislation So yes, there are some lawyers that are a part of it, but essentially you have just a whole bunch of hospitality professionals becoming, policy advocates and community activists. So we're all kind of just like pivoting and doing something none of us has ever done before.
When was his first town hall, just to give frame of reference?
We first started it, I think, like early April. It wasn't very... It wasn't very much after the quarantine started in New York when we first started doing this, but we formed as like an official entity, I would say, in May, and now we're in late August, and we formed about 20 charters, so we are in 20 states across the country, and we're working towards 50.
And to set the stage for everybody else, pre-COVID, I mean, there were thousands of small business owners, specifically in the cocktail bar scene. What was the type of association? Was it just friendly sharing of different recipes or staging? Was there any type of advocacy groups that you knew of?
There always has been. There's a lot of like sort of community-based groups around the hospitality industry. There always has been. The one that comes to mind immediately, the United States Bartenders Guild. I'm a bar guy, and so a lot of the communities that I'm really familiar with are definitely bartender and cocktail-focused industry communities. The USBG is one of them. And then, there's also these like national and international cocktail festivals like Tales of the Cocktail and the Brooklyn Bar Convent, Portland Cocktail Week. So there's all these like sort of trade focused institutions that have been around for a long time that have had a lot of communities that sort of build around people that work in the bar business. So I've always been really involved on that level. And when you're in those communities, they're very, very supportive and very educational, and people are very open and it's a great community to be a part of. And so, what we're all really doing right now is sort of just like activating all of these networks and shifting our focus from, educating each other on stuff like abstract absinthe and, forgotten cocktail recipes to, public policy.
same esoteric knowledge, just different source.
And yes, exactly.
For those who don't understand why the policy changes, I think it's helpful to talk about SARS and what insurance is covered pre-SARS and post-SARS. For those who remember, SARS was the respiratory illness that came out of China that was kind of a pre-COVID but much more contained pandemic. So what were the changes that the insurance industry made to their policy that most people didn't understand or realize?
Yeah, so this is definitely like the sticking point of the insurance companies and also our advocacy groups' argument. And so it's based on a clause that most insurance carriers have included in their policies, which is the no pandemic or no virus clause. So basically, business interruption gets triggered in a few different ways. A lot of the time they're filed due to physical damages. So things like a flood or a fire, these would be the kinds of things that could happen to your business that would, possibly force you into closure, which would therefore lead to a loss of revenue. And that's why you have your business interruption insurance. So that way, if you are forced into a closure, it's there for you. But there's a couple other, ways that it can be triggered. And, there's, what's called civil action or civil commotion. So basically that means that if there's a government body that forces you into a closure, such as like what we're experiencing specifically in New York City, and of course there's a lot of versions of varying degrees across the country of what we're experiencing here, where there's partial openings, like you're operating at 25, 50% occupancy indoors, or maybe there's only outdoor seating. There's other cities that, aren't allowing like the to-go cocktail, to-go spirits thing that's happening here in New York. But to get back to the whole SARS question and how that relates to how these different ways business interruption insurance can be triggered, the no pandemic clause basically says that it just doesn't, business interruption insurance doesn't cover pandemics and it doesn't cover viruses and things like that. But our argument, we're standing on the soapbox that says, well, this is not about a virus. We're talking about civil action. We're talking about civil commotion, where we're being forced into a loss of revenue by the government, not by the virus. The virus might make cause some other kind of effect, but we wouldn't know what that is because we're not operating at full capacity.
So really what the argument from the lawyer side is that the pandemic is not the reason why you're losing revenue. It's because of government shutdown.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And when businesses started realizing that they weren't getting paid, I'm sure it felt isolated, but what was the groundswell when you realized that this was much more of a trend and a policy and less about one or two random cases?
I mean, it was just kind of coming up everywhere, and it almost became a joke to a lot of business owners, you know, because it's just like, yeah, there's nothing we can do about it. We're getting steamrolled by the insurance company. So we just have to move on and see if we can apply for these government programs, the PPP, the CARES Act, things like that, which is understandable because we're backed up into a corner. So we're always going to be thinking of, okay, well, then what's the next thing that I can do? But quite a lot of people have like not even bothered dealing with it because they just know that there's no chance that they're going to be able to get their insurance policy fulfilled. It's something that a lot of businesses, especially bars and restaurants, I mean, to be clear, you know, we are made up of hospitality leaders and we do have a focus on restaurants and bars, but this is something that will help all small businesses. So we're not necessarily exclusionary about it, but it just kind of happens to be the spirit of, you know, where we're coming from. It's been very interesting to hear people's different stories and their experiences with their insurance policies, but they all tend to kind of be the same. But kind of what I was trying to say just before was, you know, a lot of people who work in restaurants and bars or own restaurants and bars, they have to have business interruption insurance. And a lot of other small businesses may not necessarily need to have it, but if you're dealing with a liquor license, you're dealing with alcohol, you're dealing with liabilities that are not the same as what you would be dealing with if, you know, you ran a daycare or a hardware store or something like that. There's different liabilities, of course, but you really have to pay up the ass for insurance for a restaurant. And so we all deal with insurers and insurance brokers all the time, and we know the game that they play. And, you know, it's just so frustrating how much money we all have to put into it. And it's sort of like, what are we even paying for if we're not getting anything out of it? And it's really, you know, a lot of the time it's because you have a liquor license and you can't have one without insurance.
Were there any insurance brokers, or were there any stories of people who were soothsayers about this, who called out right after SARS that this clause was being removed? Was there anybody pointing towards this as an issue, or was it relatively unnoticed?
I think it was pretty unnoticed. And I think also many of us that have benefited from the success of the culinary and hospitality and travel industry in the United States over the last 20 years, you know, we've had it pretty good. I mean, even in the 2008 recession that we experienced, there was a lot of people out of work and there was a lot of, the economy was in a really bad place, but restaurants and bars survived. And they thrived because people always need to be comforted. They always need to eat. They always need to have a cocktail. Whether you could be having a cocktail because you're down, or you could be having a drink because you're up. You know, it serves multiple purposes. And, you know, these places are key centers for a lot of people. It's where they go to be comforted. And we've always thought that we had like kind of an indestructible business, and I don't think anybody was really thinking about there ever being a pandemic. And if there was, I don't think anybody thought that restaurants and bars would be so specifically targeted. But that's the situation, and now we're Now we're seeing a $1 trillion a year business just getting torn down every single day.
And just for, you touched on this already, but what you said was that insurance companies were sitting on about $847 billion in reserves. And the yes. total cost to pay this out is $380 billion. Is there any yeah, reason that yeah. you've gotten? Go on.
No, no, please finish.
Okay, is there any reason that you've got now that, I'm sure when it was just individuals, they were just, sorry, we don't pay it. But now that there is a organized lobbying group and much more of a groundswell, what is the response that you're getting from the insurance agencies? And what has been some of the reaction to your early attempts at policy change?
Well, you know, it's been very interesting because first off, you have to figure out, you have to know how to do it. And so we, in the beginning, just building out our strategy and building out our structure has been a big focus, and, you know, establishing our charters across the United States. On our steering committee, as I had mentioned earlier, we are made up of hospitality leaders and lawyers and insurance experts and things like that. So we have people that, you know, have worked closely with insurers on the legal side of things. So we have some really high-level advisors that have been a part of helping us build this strategy and also focus on a lot of the cases that are kind of in some of the judiciary courts right now. So we're kind of able to use a lot of these case studies as examples when we go and sit down with legislators to talk about it. But this is where I would have to tell you a lot about our strategy. So if you're okay with that, I can break it all down for you.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Okay, cool. So every state in the country has an insurance committee that's made up of state senators and assembly members. And they all reside in different districts throughout any given state. And so what we've done, so we have our legal team, we also have a law students as well that have helped us map out every single one of these districts out the country. And so then at that point, what we do is we've identified the districts and we know, you know, where they're located and, you know, where their zones are. And that's where we canvass. So we're canvassing to small businesses that are within a district that's presided over by a legislator. And we're petitioning small businesses to simply just provide us with their business contact information. We also allow them to provide us with like just a brief testimony of like whatever economic hardships they might be enduring over this period of time. And what we try to do is get a minimum of 50 to 100 signatures of small businesses within a district. Once we've achieved that quota, what we'll do, I've left out one part. We have a person who we call a community organizer that's working at the district level. So that person is specifically appointed to one district. And ideally, it's somebody who is also a small business owner. So somebody that's of the community and knows the area, and, you know, somebody that, you know, is hopefully impressionable to others. And so after we've reached that quota, we'll schedule a meeting with the representative's office, and they're required to take that meeting with us. And they would probably be met with one of our legal experts, as well as myself and the community organizer. And we would sit down with that person and let them know about, you know, what kind of experiences the small businesses in the districts that they focus on are experiencing during this time. And, you know, we'll let them know what some of the challenges are as far as the policies go. And then we also provide them with a few different solutions in terms of how we think that we might be able to change it. Because really what the problem is, it's not necessarily that there's a pandemic clause in a lot of these policies. It's actually a little bit more about the legislation that interprets those policies. So the people that sit on this committee, they're the people that essentially interpret what these bills really mean. So we're trying to appeal to these officials by letting them know, look, this is your community. These are the businesses that that are here. You know, you're responsible for like the economic well-being of this area, and as well as the public safety of this community. And so we're showing you that there's 100 signatures here, and they're all asking for your help. And you know, if they're not influenced by all of that, then, you know, we also have our community organizer who's at the table, and they can say, hey, you know, like I'm one of your constituents. I'm within your district. I'm a small business owner. There's 100 small business owners here that are asking for your help. So if what you're saying is, you know, you don't support an amendment to this bill, I'm totally happy to let everybody know in the business community how you feel about it. And we'll be sure to let everybody know not to vote for you. So you kind of have a little bit of a court of public opinion pressure strategy that we apply at that point. But, you know, hopefully, you know, we don't have to get to that level with anybody, but, you know, we're suffering in a very big way. So we'll apply whatever strategy we have to in order to get these policymakers on our side.
We're going to take a quick musical break. We're going to play a song from our archives, and then we'll be back with Maxwell Breton from Thirst here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Come down, I won't come back down. I'm too burnt out again. And I know I've done this before. I'll just fall out again. I'm wasting all my time.
you mentioned that you're in 20 different states. Have you had meetings yet with legislators? And have you seen any successes, or has it mostly been still organizing and just starting to get to the table?
Yeah, we're definitely still in the organizing phase right now, to varying degrees. And we also still have, even though we're established as charters in a lot of states, we still have, you know, a lot of unassigned districts for community organizers. So a lot of focus has been built on just sort of like galvanizing the hospitality industry to try to get them to contribute, you know, some of their time and some of their efforts on these things. But we have had a few meetings with some people in local government and state government in some places. In New York, we've had a couple. We're actually in the midst of having our first meeting with the district representative for downtown Manhattan pretty soon. So we're excited about that. And so we're definitely beginning to garner some sponsors from the government that that will support us. And, we have a chapter in Washington, D.C., and they've made some really enormous strides over there. And even though we're not working on the federal level, they've been able to establish a lot of support and a lot of really great contacts from local government. And then, of course, there's also tons of these like hospitality-based advocacy coalitions that have popped up all over the place. And so it's also really important that we maintain communications with them and, you know, build out a relationship with those people so that we can really support each other and ensure that, you know, we're kind of staying in our lanes and focus on the issues that we say that we're focused on, which has also led to, you know, having some really good contacts. For me, it's been, you know, talking to some people in city council, the Chamber of Commerce. I've also been in touch with the mayor's office of nightlife. And, you know, we're really just kind of reporting to them where we're going and where we stand. And, you know, as we continue to grow and build our credibility, then we'll be able to have more and more people sign on with us. So, yeah, we're definitely making a lot of great progress. We've been able to get a lot of excellent supporters on the government side of things so far, but we haven't had quite as many meetings with legislators just yet. And that's mostly just because we really need to make sure that we have as many small businesses as we can signed up as members with our organization.
For a independent business owner who is listening right now and wants to join, what are the steps of outreach and getting themselves involved?
There's a couple. And if you want to get in touch with me directly, I am the chairman of the organization, but I'm also the state organizer for New York. So that means that if you're in New York, you can contact me directly and I can help you out. Or if you're in another state, maybe you're in a state where there hasn't been a charter established just yet and you'd like to start one, I can also help you with that. And my email address is M as in Maxwell, B as in Britain, at maxwellbritain.com. If you feel more comfortable going to our website, that's also an option. So our website is thirstgroup.org, and there's a sign-up page over there, and that would be an enormous help to us. And so if you're not sure if you can make the commitment of dedicating 2 hours every week to us, just taking 25 seconds to go to our website and provide us with your contact information and your business information, we would really, really appreciate that. And we also act as a resource as well, and that's a really important thing that I've left out. So what we're trying to do, this is a extremely ambitious endeavor, to put it mildly. And in the short term, while we're, you know, building out our infrastructure, building out our signatures and our chapters, et cetera, as I've mentioned, we have a really great legal team. We have insurance experts. So we're also able to act as a resource. Because a really big thing is, even if people feel like they know they're not going to get their insurance policy approved, they should still file a claim. And that's a really important part to the case that we're building right now. So we can act as a resource to help you file your claim. And if you're looking for any further counsel, we can also connect you with some of the top legal teams in the country for business interruption insurance.
Assuming that this gets sorted in the short to medium term, in the long term for Thirst, I think it's really interesting that you have the words reimagined and security as part of your title. You've been in the industry for a long time. You've won some of the top accolades. I'm sure you've seen the best and the worst it has to offer. What do you think when all of this is rebuilt? What stays and what do you hope stays away?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I'm not sure if I can provide you with a full answer, but, you know, I think it's just interesting because there's still, I think there's a lot of states where there's still a great deal of just starting financial inequities in a lot of restaurants and bars. And that's been a topic for a long time because we're looking at everything from hourly tip waged workers who, you know, are making $5 an hour to, you know, the line cooks that are, you know, sweating in kitchens for 13 hours a day, making, you know, $11 an hour. And so, you know, I think the state of New York has actually done a pretty good job of addressing some of those things. So we have a guaranteed minimum wage in New York for hospitality workers that work in the front of house. So, everybody's guaranteed $10 an hour. And, since they're making tips, if they don't make a minimum of $15 an hour combined with their $10 an hour base, then the business is responsible for making them whole so that they're meeting that minimum wage. So, you know, we have a few good things going on there, but, you know, there's still a lot of inequities in terms of, like, what people are getting in back of house. There's the ongoing argument about, you know, should tipping be abolished? And, you know, I got to say, I'm a bartender at heart. That's where I started. And I've always believed that tips are a very important part of the American hospitality experience. And a lot of people would disagree with that. But there are also a lot of people that don't. And I think that if you ask most bartenders, they would probably say they would not want to work in a restaurant or bar where they couldn't make tips. But there are other inequities that aren't money. And I think a lot of it has to do with, it's kind of paired with, you know, the underbelly of a lot of these racial injustices that we're experiencing in this country right now. And, you know, you see that, you can see some of these things in a lot of, you know, great cocktail bars and fine dining restaurants where, you know, there's not a lot of diversity. You know, there can be a lot of places where there's not, you know, people of color and there's not maybe a lot of females working. And so I think that, you know, this is not quite as much part of, you know, what I'm currently doing, but, you know, all of these things are happening at the same time. And, you know, a lot of the ugly parts of the industry are kind of showing their faces to us right now. And it's impossible to look away. And we have to come to terms with that and create opportunities where there's more equality in the workplace, especially amongst people of color and females as well. So I'm hoping to see that as a recognition that is a change for good for restaurants and bars of the future.
As we mentioned at the top of the show, you're a man of many talents and wearer of many hats. You oversee Django in the basement of the Roxy Hotel, which has one mm-hmm. of the best jazz programs in the city. How have you adjusted to coronavirus performances and supporting the artists that play your space?
Yeah, so I have spent a lot of time recently thinking about that. Because up until, I guess, mid-July, I've been really, really focused on helping every small business and being very business focused. You know, I started thinking a lot about all the musicians that I've employed for the past 4 years. And these are really great people. These are really talented artists, and they represent, you know, the arts and the culture of New York City. And, you know, while everyone's talking about, like, so worried about businesses, and of course they represent jobs, you know, there are artists out there that are really, really stuck. And I think that especially music venues are taking an even harder hit than a lot of restaurants and bars and hotels, because they tend to be, you know, sometimes larger spaces. There's a lot of music, which means people talking loudly. Music can cause people to dance, people getting close to each other. So we kind of have like a national footloose martial law on us. And I've just been trying to think through different ways that I can support all of the people, the artists that have really supported me over the years. And so I sort of started a musician's fund, and I'm just trying to raise money for the guys that have really supported me over the years. And then I developed an idea where we would really put them back to work by raising a little bit of money and basically recording virtual shows where, you know, I can actually pay these guys like, you know, actual performance fees, and they get to do what they love, which is play music, and I get to do what I love, which is, you know, giving people a job, and of course also giving, you know, the audience, the consumers that are at home, music and culture back into their living rooms, since they can actually do it in person.
Amazing. And where are people able to watch this, or how are they able to participate in the events?
So we're going to be releasing some episodes over the next couple weeks, and you'll be able to see it on our Instagram page. We'll have some links on there. And there's a little bit more that I'm hoping to put out there, and I'm really hoping that this might lead to some more opportunity to continue paying musicians and continue to bring into people's homes. So there's going to be plenty of updates. And so our Instagram page, which is the Django NYC, is a great place to get updates on that.
Amazing. Well, Maxwell, thank you for joining us today, and really incredible the efforts that you and Thirst are doing. For people who didn't get it the first time, can you provide the contact information and or how they can find you?
Yeah, of course. So the website is thirstgroup.org, and if you are a business owner, please sign up and provide us with your business information, and we'll support you. If you are not a business owner, we still need help. We still need to support businesses, and if you to get involved, there's an option that says get involved on the page. You can just click that link. And if you'd like to talk to me directly, or if you'd like to start a charter or just find other creative ways of collaborating with me, I can reach at M as in Maxwell, B as in Britain, at maxwellbritain.com.
Incredible. We're going to play another song from the archives, and then we'll be back with the second half of Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
Check. Yeah.
I'm Brian Kenny, a board member at HRN and director of collections and archives for Hearst Western Properties. Hearst Ranch beef is 100% grass-fed, free-range, and always antibiotic-free. I recently recorded an episode of HRN on Tour with the division manager for Hearst Ranch, Roland Camacho. We talked about what makes Hearst Ranch beef unique. I think it's notable that all of the beef produced off the ranches are basically within the food shed, you know, within a couple hundred miles of the ranch, which is really cool.
Yeah, it is. And we're looking into doing other things. I mean, we've been working with Whole Foods now for quite a long time.
Yeah.
But we've also continued to make a small selection of frozen items that people can buy on a year-round basis. And one of the other trends that I've seen pick up massive momentum in the past 3 to 5 years is, you know, going back towards people buying their monthly beef needs or meat needs, protein needs, and having it shipped direct to their house. What I see has changed is instead of hand-picking what you think you want to go in there, you trust the company that is providing it to you to give you the variety that you need for your complete diet needs. So you might you trust that they're going to be sourcing credible beef, and you may not know as much as these guys do. You trust that they're going to give you the variety so you can expand your palate.
Our beef will be available in Whole Foods Market's 44 California locations from San Luis Obispo to San Diego throughout the summer beginning June 1st. You can also order our 100% grass-fed beef online as part of a partnership with Larder Meat Company. Visit HearstRanch.com. That's H-E-A-R-S-T Ranch.com.
Welcome back, Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. We have 88 Palms live in studio today. Welcome.
Hi. Hello. Hey.
Well, we've got two off mic and one on mic. So do you want to introduce who's in the room?
So we have Caito Sanchez and Joshua Ruha, two of my guys. We all play together around town. We're missing Jonathan Granoff and Morgan Wiley, who play bass and keys with us. They're elsewhere in the world today.
And Morgan, for old Snacky Tunes listeners, might remember when he was on as Midnight Magic, which is what we heard right before we came back from break.
Yes, and Caito plays with Midnight Magic as well.
Yeah, I think that was 8 years ago,
yeah,
which is crazy.
Yeah.
So we did that here, don't we?
Yeah, we did it here.
Everybody,
we fit all six people in here, plus us, plus friends. It was pretty crammed in. I think that was one of the most packed we'd ever done.
Summer day, no?
It was hot. Yeah. It was great, though. I mean, I feel like that was it, all this and this music is also just like all summer tropical, really amazing summer vibes.
Yes.
Right before we started, you had mentioned that there's a number of rules for 88 Palms. Rule number three being keep a jazz mentality. What are some of the other rules and how have they developed and affected the way the band creates and performs?
The number one rule is don't look Rhea in the eyes.
Perfect. Sorry, I've broken it.
Which everyone breaks all the time, but just know that I'll come for you in some sort of way. Like
eyes or eyes?
Eyes. Don't look Rhea in the eyes. Caito gets the other view most of the time.
As the drummer.
Classic drummer view.
Classic drummer view. Let's see. Number two is vibes. Just vibes. Just feel it. Just go with it. We end up improvising a lot because we all have so many other different projects going on. There's not a lot of time for rehearsals and practicing. So. It ends up being a lot of jazz. Rule number three, jazz mentality. Keep it, you know, there are no wrong chords, just jazz chords.
Well, it's more about the performance, you know, like I feel like jazz musicians are just so good on their craft that they don't rehearse. Yeah. And they know the tune, they just like, okay, be comfortable, very solid, very confident, but also be playful.
It's really, I mean, it's like, here's the structure, you know, the song. Exactly. Play within it, play around it.
Listen to everybody, it's a conversation.
Listen to everybody. Right, yeah, the conversation place, especially for people, I mean, you're all in bands,
You're all from diverse backgrounds. You're all from different musical upbringings. But, you know, when bands try to play the same note every time, especially when it's this type of music, it feels a little soulless.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's. I think that's one of the fun things about the 88 Palms shows is nobody ever gets the same show twice.
It's well, like, yeah. Even if you want it.
Yeah, yeah. Even if we tried to put a structure on it and make it a thing, you know, inevitably somebody's going to kind of be in a moment and I'm looking at Kaito like...
Yeah, how do you deal with that type of... I mean, you've only been playing live since 2017, so
yeah.
The live show is still relatively new. How do you communicate, and how do you let someone just... If they're living inside a moment, how do you let them live without getting frustrated?
There's no frustration. I mean, you know, we've all been playing together in different respects for long enough, but it's like we recognize when somebody is kind of feeling something, and in a moment, like, I like to just let them have that moment. Sometimes it's me, sometimes it's Kaito, sometimes it's Josh, sometimes it's Dominica from Underground System, who joined us on flute the other day, you know, and I just let her rip and do her thing, you know, until it felt like the right moment to go back into the track.
That's amazing. And so, like, the songs are structured, I mean, obviously the recorded is you set something down, but how did you get to, for the EP, a structure that for a show that's ever evolving, and I'm sure practice is the same way, how did you go, okay, that's the version?
Honestly, a lot of the EP, Morgan and I wrote really quickly together. I kind of came into the studio one day, and he had a couple kind of like ideas floating around that he had started, and he was playing me a bunch of stuff, and I started kind of improvising and singing on top of it. He stuck a microphone in front of me, and, you know, we very quickly had kind of rough ideas of what the songs were going to be. We did a little bit of fine-tuning in terms of, like, the arrangements and structures, but the versions that are on the EP are not that different. And they're pretty non-traditional structurally.
Yes.
Which is kind of a byproduct of
rule number two.
Rule number two, which is jazz
vibes.
Mentality.
No, that's rule number
vibes.
Three.
Just feeling it. And, you know, like, I hadn't really written a lot of stuff like that with anybody else previous to that. So both of us were just kind of going off of, like, I don't know, does it feel right? Does it feel like it should end here? And not really operating within a traditional songwriting structure. Which makes it really challenging and really interesting to do these songs live.
Can we hear something live?
Yeah, let's play something live.
What are you going to play for us first?
So this first song is called Downtown. This is another one. We have a little... This isn't out on, you know, Spotify and all of that just yet. This is on our SoundCloud. We have a little mixtape that we threw up that's just a lot of kind of really... fun, housier, easy things that we just threw together that we'll be releasing at some point, but...
Sometime.
You know, one thing at a time here.
Well, here we go with 88 Palms Live on Snacky Tunes.
Downtown, I wanna take you where you won't make a sound. Downtown, the DJ plays my song when we come around. Downtown, pick me up, baby, let's hit the town. Downtown, the DJ plays my song when we come around, around, around. Downtown, I wanna take you where you won't make a sound. Downtown, the streets are dripping with the love that we found. needs are ours, baby, give me the crown, the crown, the crown. Down, down, the DJ plays my song when we come around, around, around. We own the night, it's yours and mine. These lights so bright, come out with me tonight. I wanna take you where you won't make a sound. I wanna take you with the love that we found. The DJ plays my song when we come around downtown.
I couldn't help but eavesdrop while you were doing soundtrack, and you said that Jessica Rabbit was a guiding light from your childhood to present day.
Yeah.
How does that work?
How does that work? I was just, I guess, really inspired by this powerful female character who used her kind of talents and abilities in order to kind of transport people to another kind of fantasy realm, I think. Oh, wow. Oh, we have pizza now. This is incredible.
Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes. Wow. Yeah, and I just always, obviously, she's very beautiful character, and I always really respected the fact, too, that she loved little Roger Rabbit for his talents and abilities and not necessarily based on looks like a, you know, like a woman of her stature could. So, yeah, and I just love that. I love the sexiness of it and the embracing that sexuality and like kind of, and not shying away from it was, I think, an important part of that.
I think the other interesting thing too is that this has, your sound has such like a classic New York disco, but most of you from the West Coast. So how did that sound become the guiding light as well for 88 Palms, and how does that kind of reflect, you know, the music that you make as a band?
So I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah, originally, but my father's from Mexico, so I grew up spending a lot of time in Mexico as well, like beaches and palm trees and kind of tropical vibes. Morgan is from Las Vegas originally, spent some time in LA, and we both just have this kind of like desert affinity for this sort of like tropical sound. But then, you know, both of us ended up transplanting to New York City, and I mean, and Caito as well, who plays a lot of the percussion and guitar and bass too on the whole record, from Panama, and been in New York as well. And so there's a definite wide range of influences. My father was a disco DJ in the 70s in Mexico.
Really? Do you know the name of the clubs?
Have you ever heard of a little club called Señor Frogs?
Oh, well, of course. It's like Pizzeria Uno, and like the original is amazing, and every other one is terrible.
Yes,
but like the original is like, oh well, if they're all like this, this makes sense.
Yeah,
you probably playing the original.
Yeah, yeah, so the original one was in Mazatlan, Sinaloa, in the 70s, and his best friend from high school started it. So they were all running.
He knew Senor Frog, the original.
El Senor Frog.
El Senor Frog.
Oh, is that a dude?
No. But if his friend started it, yeah.
It's Apple.
Yeah. So it's Apple. So that was how. So he started. You know, he was bartending and bar backing and a waiter and DJing and. And at that time, a lot of the music cats from LA would come down to get away from the scene there. It was a little bit, it sounds like kind of what Tulum is to New York right now,
sure.
You know, where everyone goes to get away. So my dad was, you know, running hotels and nightclubs in that scene and doing like volleyball on the beach with Bob Dylan and dancing with John Travolta in the clubs. And he, you know, raised me with a very like prominent disco kind of mentality that I didn't embrace at first when I was in my heavy rock and roll phase.
Sure.
And then as I got older and got more into, you know, like dance music and house and its origins in disco, I began to understand that Papa Alberto really actually knew what he was talking about.
We eventually get there. Is there one record that sums up your child? Like, if you heard it, it would take you right back to your dad playing records for you?
Anything Beatles or Led Zeppelin.
But not a disco record?
But not the disco. The disco didn't come until later. I think one of the things that really cemented that for me, he gave me my first Depeche Mode CD when I was like 15, and that really changed a lot of things for me. And then it was like, I remember around the time when Daft Punk released their last album, Random Access Memories, and asking my dad about Nile Rodgers and him sort of giving me like a verbal backhand and being like, of course I know about Nile Rodgers and Marauder and Donna Summer and all. And he was like...
Speaking of Marauder, he just announced his first live tour ever at like 79.
Whoa.
Yeah.
He's a beast, man.
Giorgio Moroder, like 4 dates in the UK.
A lot of respect for Moroder.
Yeah, sure. Take your time. Yeah. Take your time. Can we hear another song?
Yeah, let's do another one. This is... we just decided to do this one on the fly. Switch it up, do something a little faster. This is called Show Me What You Taste Like. And this is not out yet either. We're just doing a bunch of exclusives for you guys today.
Perfect. We love a Snacky Tunes exclusive. We used to have an air horn that when anyone would say that, but that air horn got retired, so... Yeah, there it is. Yeah, thank you. Yes, the 88 Palms version of an air horn. Perfect.
I don't wanna see you, baby, love you. take it to the top. Show me how I don't wanna do. Stop.
You mentioned that you're always in a phase of recording. How does that work, especially with all these demos and everything? Is it just one at a time? Is it who's ever around? I mean, it's an eclectic group of musicians to pin down in a room. So how does that work?
Yeah. So usually how it ends up working is, I mean, it's really, honestly, it's really hard anytime we meet up in the studio to not write something new. And it's also really cool, the space we work out of in Greenpoint, there's always all kinds of amazing people sort of floating around the space, and you never really know who's gonna like drop in or be around. And so a lot of the what's on the EP, you know, Morgan and I kind of wrote the basis for it together, and then, you know, as he's in the studio and people are coming by, he can kind of like grab people and like, hey, can you lay down a bass part on this real quick? Hey, you want to do some drums on this? Hey, you want to do some guitar? And then we kind of come back together and like retool the whole thing, and or sometimes we'll be in there working on something and someone shows up and they have something to contribute. So it's just like, yeah, it's that kind of jazz mentality again, where it's
rule
just like
three.
Free form recording. Rule number one is, yeah.
Well, but, we've all broken the, I'm sorry, I keep breaking rule number one. I keep looking at you. I apologize. I'll just stare at you. Ask questions over there. Yes.
If you
want to
talk to Ria,
yeah,
you're going to have to get through
Kaito. Look there, and then she'll wink. And then it'll come back to me. So you have a DJ gig coming up on the 17th. What can one expect in a DJ set?
That one's just, I'm going to be DJing. Josh is going to be there with me. We're going to play a little set at Gospel in Soho on Wednesday. My good friend Sean Glass does a little party there called Reunion, where he kind of brings together all of his contacts from all these various different industries and just makes a really cool party about it. So we're going to do a couple of live songs, and then I'll DJ a little bit with him and some other people. The DJ sets are, you know, it's a lot of stuff that that I'm inspired by, that I'm really into right now. A lot of house and disco edits, obviously.
Of course.
I'm really looking forward to that.
And then you're playing the McKittrick Hotel Halloween party, which I was at last year, and it is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It is one of the best times ever. I think I've actually been a few years in a row. What will you be in costume? What will the attire be? It's three different nights. Is that three different costumes? Like, how does it work? What's the plan?
Yeah, so I'm in the process of figuring that out right now, actually. You know, stylists and designers, get at me. We've got a lot of dressing to do.
I'm in between Mexican Elvis, Miles Davis, Teddy Gross.
Teddy Pentagram?
Teddy Gross. Teddy Pentagram is... That's a good one, actually.
That's actually a very good one. For Halloween, that's very good.
That's how Charles Bradley used to call him.
Oh, really?
Teddy Pentagram.
Yeah. Close enough.
So three different nights. It's, I guess the theme is like a kind of like haunted dystopian thing. So I'm feeling... Personally, I'm feeling a lot of like Blade Runner type...
Naturally.
Vibes, perfect. Which is, you know, very Leather. Close to my heart as well. So, I don't know. It's loose. But then we're playing in the Mandalay Bar, which is like this very jazzy, like dark, sexy kind of room. So, honestly, at this point, I have no idea. I'm just going to... This is how I do Halloween every year. I have so many fun outfits in my closet. I just kind of pull something out and...
Like, I get the most amazing ideas like around June.
Around June. Right,
like yeah. May. Yeah. Something like, this is a great idea. And
so,
I always think
set.
About like I should write them and I forget them. And it's like when it's close to Halloween, I just like, I forgot this amazing idea I had and I got hung on that.
I like, you can you be know? Teddy like Pentagram, had, like, I'll be Jessica Rabbit.
Yes.
Josh?
To be determined. All right, well, I want to make sure we have time for one more song. Where can people find your music, get your tour dates, hear your SoundCloud mixes?
So we're on all digital platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Music, Amazon, all these things. We're honestly, most of the tour dates and everything is through Instagram at 88 Palms.
Not taken. So important these days.
So important. So, so that's, I think, the best way to kind of keep up with us, because that's the only thing that I have time to update most of the time. So,
perfect. Well, we want to thank Bruce Bromberg for talking with Darren early in the episode. Thank you to Andrew Poso for putting us all together.
Thanks, Andrew.
Jeet, our new sound engineer. Welcome to the family. Pleasure thank you, having Jeet. You. Thank you to Kong as well. Thanks for listening to Snacky Tunes. We'll be back with an all-new episode next week. What are you going to take us out with?
This is Hollywood Sun. We're going to take you to the West Coast for a little bit of dreamy landscapes.
Perfect. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Your show.
talk about food, we talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.